all the forces have come together just in such an obviously sinister way that you can't even ignore it. It's Friday night to begin with, and it's March. Now, March always means out in that deep, inverted, unfathomable, or is it infathomable? Unfathomable? That unfathomable Stygian bowl of the Midwest? That vast sea of unplumbed farina? The Midwest? March always means that you have turned the corner. Now, it's March. It's Friday night. And there is weather out there. Oh, that wind blowing and that glop coming down and the snow and the slush up to the neck. It gives me a sense of almost unbridled passion. Almost unbridled and dangerous passion that tonight could very well lead to total disaster. For example, I could spend the next 35 minutes head thumping if given just the slightest encouragement. I could sing 14 choruses, not one of them the same, of Ragtime Cowboy Joe. For that matter, I'll show you something here. Give me a little bit of help. You are listening to the greatest gum popper in the Western Hemisphere. Seriously. I can pop gum like nobody you've ever heard pop gum. Matter of fact, I even got a role in a play once because I could pop my gum so good. You know what I mean? Had a single line. Guess what it was? Just getting warmed up. Now, of course, there's a lot of things that are in the wind that we might as well bring right out. It's Friday night, and I just feel that way. I don't know whether or not I'm thinking seriously of talking about the big embarrassment that I saw one time in the Army, which always reminds me of Friday night. On the other hand, speaking of big embarrassments, and for those of you who are missing the newspapers, here is a little piece of news, which I think is one of those little tiny straws in the wind. One of those little pieces, a little flotsam, a little bit of jetsam, which will probably, in the end, probably 1,000 years from now, be looked upon by anthropologists or sociologists as a turning point. Listen to this, Ed. I read to you now. Get ready with a piece of mood music in there for this. We'll call for it when it's needed. This is from Colonia, New Jersey. Colonia, New Jersey. All set with the news? Now, I don't get it hung up there. It's from Colonia, New Jersey. Is there such a town, or is this just one of those things that they put at the head of a, you know, just a slug? Is there a Colonia, New Jersey? Well, I presume they talk like Jersey. Colonia, New Jersey. Everyone knows we live in a rapidly changing world. But not everyone realizes how rapidly our world is changing. It was something of a shock to the older teachers at School 22 in Colonial, New Jersey, when a fourth grader was unable to identify, quote, the black stone he found on the site of an old Colonial farmhouse. It was even a greater shock when his teacher also failed to identify the, quote, stone. The black stone brought to Mrs. Flores Augustine, principal, for identification turned out to be a lump of common coal. Hold it there, Ed. See, we turned the corner. It mystified the entire group. One thing I'm sure that it's going to do to this kid in this, what is it, the second grade? Yeah, the second, fourth grade yet. It's going to shake his entire belief in the educational system of America. His teacher couldn't identify a lump of coal. Well, the question then arises, what can she identify? Of course, it's open to question. I'm not questioning the colonial school system. I'm merely saying that is understandable, madam, in the mid-20th century. That I really see coming over the horizon there, the day when pupils will be asked to identify that rare substance, sand. And they will be thrown by it. They'll find actual sand in their shoes, and it will frighten them. Kids will find rocks. Another kid will see a piece of the sky one day and come back and say, what is that blue thing that I saw just over the top of the big TV antenna there the other day? And the teacher, of course, will be unable to identify it because the teacher will be buried, as usual, completely in the world of the academician. Now, I'll never forget the time, speaking of one of the most embarrassing moments I've ever seen, as long as we're going to talk about not being able to identify the real world. I was an amateur radio operator when I was a kid, and still am, by the way, if any of you are interested. I've had my ticket continuously since I was about a foot and a half tall. And I'm officially what they call an OM. Very official. I've had my ticket a long time. And so, well, I'll tell you, when I got my ticket, they used to hand, for those of you who are hams, you'll know what I'm talking about. When I got my ticket, they were giving out great big blue certificates that you hung on the wall. You know the big ones, Eddie? So that's how long ago. But nevertheless, I've had my ticket continuously. But here's the thing that I'm driving at. When, of course, I grew up in the world of pragmatic radio. By pragmatic, I'm talking about operative actual radio. I mean, a resistor, a 2,500-ohm resistor, you grab it immediately. You know what it is. I could read the color code before I could read the ABCs. Seriously. I could see a resistor. Believe me, I could read that color code. When I would see cars going down the street, I'd color code them. Oh, yeah, I'd see a red car with a black dot, you know, and green stripe on the front there. I immediately know what the resistance of the thing was. So I was a great man for the color code at the age of about 7. By the time I was 9, every sound that I heard around me was part of the gigantic Morse code of existence. The door would squeak. My mother would be attempting to communicate with me, I would suspect, in an underhanded fashion. When somebody would slam a cash register and it would creak and bang about five or six different ways, I'd crack up. I could hear obscenity where no obscenity was written on any wall, just by the tooting of the horns in the loop. Seriously. Any guy who can read code can stand on the street corner over here at 42nd and 5th Avenue and in an hour listen to more unconscious conversation than you will hear in a week in the subway. Where do you hear it? You hear it from the horns. You hear it from the horns and the bus door squeaking and everything. That is all code. Like it goes, it has just said A. That's right. And things, and you'd hear some terrible thing. Somebody has just been called an awful name. I can't tell you what it is. Any ham out there knows what I just said. even our engineers here can't catch that one. But nevertheless, that's right, the old FCC will be on the phone. Speaking of the FCC, this is WOR AM and FM New York, and we'll be here until the scores come back. And while we're on the subject of the scores coming back, we have a note here. Let's get some of these commercials out of the way. Oh, that got faster there. I'm going to start giving my call. I'm going to start making the station breaks, Ted, in CW. You know, there's no law against it. As long as the human voice that does it. Yeah, there is a law against ICW, but not a law against me doing it. ICW is intermittent continuous wave. That would be as if I put an audio signal on here and did it that way, you see. But if I go, just as legal as your station break, you think not? Oh, watch this. I just gave our call letter and the city we operate from. Well, so it goes. Let's get these commercials out of the way here first. Camera fans, run. Don't.
Everybody's going to the carnival. Plus Saver Value Carnival. You get top value, top deal, too. Plus Saver's the buy-in house.
Yes, the original lyrics getting around. The best deal in town is at your Buick dealers during his great La Sabre Value Carnival.
I'll tell you that.
But you'd better hurry because this exciting event will last only a few more days. Think twice. You'll probably pay the price of a La Sabre by Buick. Why not own one? It's got advanced thrust engineering, the Husky Wildcat engine, satin smooth turbine drive, exclusive Buick features that keep maintenance costs down, resale value up. All this, yet La Sabre is priced so close to the low price name. But time is short. See your Buick dealer this week.
Hey, have you heard any of these Homer and Jethro commercials on the air? They're great. Well, the reason I bring up Homer and Jethro, they say, hey, Homer, yeah, what do you want, Jethro? Well, let's tell them about some of these corny things we've been talking about. I tell you about the time my aunt got a set of wooden teeth. Wooden teeth! No kidding, Homer. Yeah, Jethro, wooden teeth. Trouble is, she had trouble with the stock. Oh, no, that's corny. You remember those? Homer and Jethro? You've been doing those spots. Well, let me tell you about Homer and Jethro. I used to work with Homer and Jethro years ago when I was doing a hillbilly show. And Homer and Jethro were even funnier. I don't know how to express it except to say that Homer and Jethro, in a very peculiar, sneaky way, comment on the entire phenomenon of folk music singing. They always did. And even the Homer, of course, I don't know how they do down at the bitter end. I'll tell you, they'd give Woody Allen trouble if I know Homer. Speaking of commercials, let's get some of the other ones out of the way here. We have the paperback gallery here, which is really the paper book gallery down on 6th Avenue at, what else we got here? Oh, opera promo. Let's see. Are they going to trust me with the opera promo this week? Umberto Giordano's Andrea Chenier will be heard on this season's 14th live Met opera presentation on WOR tomorrow at 2. Commentary on the NBC network yet. Now, let's get back to this thing here. I'll tell you about one of the... You think you've seen embarrassing moments? One of the worst, terrible, saddest, wildest, embarrassing moment I have ever seen, public embarrassing moment, occurred when I was in the Army. And let me tell you, it's very hard to get embarrassed in the Army. There is very little that after you're in the Army for a while, you've seen it all, Dad. And if what you haven't seen just isn't embarrassing. It isn't worth seeing, as a matter of fact. After a while in the Army, you've seen every bit of it. Well, oh, you should have seen the sad letter I just got from a listener who's up in Greenland. Speaking of guys in the Army. But I'll tell you about this embarrassing moment. I don't know whether you're aware of it or not, but all the bugle calls in the Army are on tape. Yes, there are no buglers in the Army. At least I never saw any buglers in the Army. I suppose in some of the classical posts, like West Point, a place like that once in a while, they might have a real bugler, you know, with a bugle. But this is not at all a practice anywhere in the Army. It was one of the great disillusionments that I first realized in the Army, that it was all totally recorded, everything. You know the stories about the Army sergeant you hear? The guys, oh, fall out, you're already on record. Yeah, they got rotten people on record and everything in the Army. It's all totally automated. And even when I was in the Army, it was very disappointing. And about every 25 or 30 feet in the Army, in the big camps, they have a gigantic telephone pole. And on the top of the telephone pole, Ed, there are about 5 enormous horn dynamic speakers. You know the kind that take about 1,200 watts of audio? Great big stadium speakers. You get the feeling of how it must be in Russia. Do you know that in towns in Russia, are you aware of this? That in towns in Russia, in little towns all up and down throughout the Siberian area and the Ukraine, little towns, they have right in the middle of the town a very high pole, and on the top of the pole are the loudspeakers, and the loudspeakers broadcast Radio Moscow day and night at full blast. No, I'm not kidding you. It's the truth. No, it is the absolute truth. No, I'm not telling you this. No, this is not a secret. It's the truth. Because many of these places don't have radios or anything. And also, you can't escape from the sound. Well, in the Army, it is like that even in spades. Because, you know, you got to get a pass, you can't go out. And this stuff is coming over the big speakers all the time. It starts, what kind of stuff? Well, it starts at about 10 minutes after 5 with a cannon. They have a recorded cannon. Boom! It goes like that on these speakers all over the joint. Well, of course, you fly right out of the sack. And the minute you hit the ground running, this thing is playing Semper Vitalis at about 18 million watts of audio, and it's spraying it all over the ground. You can feel the ground shake under you and all this stuff. And then immediately after that, these recorded bugle calls start going. You know, I'll award the brass figurine to any of you who can tell me what that call is. What's that call? I'll give you another one. You never hear that one, do you? Then there's one that goes. Ah 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 What's that one? You don't know any of those. Well, I'm not playing them very good. Well, nevertheless, this is night and day, you see. And when they play Taps, recorded Taps comes floating out throughout the hills, which is the last one you hear. You know that you won't be hearing any bugles unless something wild happens until again, early morning, when they start playing Reveille. Of course, everybody knows Reveille. You know how Reveille goes? Oh, God, I don't even... goes endlessly on and on and on. It blows in one ear and out the other. Well, that's the sound that goes on. Well, to get down to the story, we had this recorded bugle. And this bugle is going off all the time. It's just blowing us out. Well, one day, one of the guys, there was a guy came into our outfit. We had this outfit that was very constantly shifting. It was a casual outfit, and there were different guys all the time. And there was a guy named who arrived in the company one day named Homer Croft. I always remember Homer. Homer Croft was from Tennessee. And you know the stereotype of the aggressive Southerner. Now all of us know the recessive Southerner that is constantly being portrayed rather, Tennessee Williams. That's the soft Southerner, you know, who's having all kinds of gland trouble and everything. Well, this was the aggressive Southerner, and this guy was from Southern Tennessee. And he was the kind of guy who, well, there was a phrase in the Army that they used all the time. One of the things that he was a shortstop. You know what a shortstop is, Ed? Well, a shortstop. I will award the brass figlegee with bronze oak leaf palm to any ex-GI out there who can tell me what a shortstop is. Well, this guy was an aggressive, tall, skinny Southerner who used to hit the jug and would come in on a Sunday night fist fighting all the way from he'd come in through the gate and he's fist fighting all the way into Company K, fist fighting every way. You get in the bus with this guy, with Homer Croft, and he's fighting all the way down the line, and about 27 guys from the barracks would grab him and hold him, just literally drag him right in. The first guy that would see Croft would sneak up behind him when you'd see him in town. When it's about 5 or 6 or 7 o'clock, you were supposed to be in at 9. If you saw Croft in town about 5 or 6, there was only one thing you did. You got behind him, and when he wasn't looking, you grabbed him around the waist and tackled him. Immediately, about 6 other guys from Company K would pile on, and you'd drag him in, because it was trouble for all of us if we didn't get him back. So that was the way it was. So Croft is the aggressive kind of Southerner. He's always saying, "All right, you son of guns, any one of you guys want to fight, I'll take on the whole damn barracks." Well, you know, everybody's tired. We're sitting around shining our shoes. Who wants to take on Croft again, you know? This is like the 14th time this week that Croft has come reeling in from the PX with the 3-point. He would get drunk just thinking of the weekend. And you know, it got to be pretty irritating. And Croft, among other things, every time the bugle would go off, on recording, and if you happen to be around Croft, Croft would curl his southern lip. And they curl better than any lips I ever saw. He would curl that southern lip, and he'd say, "Listen to that nothing bugler. Guy can't blow his nose." Well, he was a recorded bugler, you know. Nobody's going to get mad at that, but that's the way he always talked. And the rumor got out that Croft was one hell of a bugler. Excuse the expression, but that's what they called him in the Army. The word got out that Croft was a bugler in civilian life. I don't know where you get buglers in civilian life. Maybe he ran a Boy Scout outfit or something, but Croft was a bugler. So Croft was always sitting back, way in the back of the barracks, on the top of his footlocker with a comb. And he's blowing the comb. He would play the bugle calls on the... Well, Croft was a bugler. Everyone says, "Boy, Croft is a bugler." Well, the whole thing in the Army was to try to get a good deal. That's what the enemy was, most generally. I mean, it was trying to get work a deal. And, of course, one of the good deals in the Army was to get in the band. Well, I'll tell you a terrible secret. The band did not have any buglers, in case you're interested. They had a lot of saxophone players, a lot of guys that played timpani, guys that played triangle, but no buglers, because they didn't use buglers in the Army. It was all recorded. One guy blew it all for everybody, apparently, you see. So there was one big day Never forget how this happened. Of course, it was general common knowledge. You got to understand that. It was common knowledge that Croft was a bugler. And Croft did everything to augment the rumor. As a matter of fact, Croft was talking about bugle calls that they never blew in the Army. He was talking about old cavalry calls. He would say, "You ever hear some of the real old cavalry calls? I'll play you one of the cavalry calls from the old West Virginia blues." All right, now listen to this. Battle of the Wilderness. The Battle of the Wilderness. You want to hear one of the East Virginia Rifles, the 7th Grenadiers? Listen to this one. Appomattox. This guy was blowing bugle calls that had been obsolete before Washington made corporal. I mean, it was that kind of stuff. And so he was the definitive bugler, and he really was. And guys would sit around and they would say, Hey, Croft. Once in a while, an old army man would come in, you know, and he'd say, "Hey, Croft, I hear you know how to blow a horn." He'd say, "Yeah." He'd say, "Hey, Croft, how about this one?" Croft would sit there, "Well, wait a minute, let me hear that one again. Let me hear that again. Let me blow that last phrase again." He said, "I know what that one is." He said, "What is it?" He said, "That's the 7th Prussian Grenadiers. I know that one. That's their retreat." And then the other guy said, "Well, I swan." And that would be the end of that. He was a definitive bugler. Well, it finally came to pass on a beautiful spring night. You know, there is very few things. May I tell you this, too? There's a strange thing about the Army. The Army has its odd moments of beauty. It really does. And even the most profound Army hater has to concede it. There are moments of great beauty in the Army. And they come at very unexpected times. And I remember the time, this came at that time. One of the great moments of beauty in the Army is in the spring, if you happen to be lucky and in a fairly decent place. In the spring, once in a while, there is a beautiful sunset. It's kind of getting warm, you know, the winter is over. And there's things in the air. You know how spring is? And it is this beautiful moment of retreat. Now, you know what retreat is in the Army, don't you? There's a big formation. And retreat always occurs just before supper. Now, what happens is that you've finished all your work for the day, all the crud and all the jazz that's gone on, all the lousy details. I almost said what they really call them in the Army. And you finished all this stuff, you know, and you've gone down to the latrine and you've washed all the ashes out of your ears and all the chicken entrails out of your shoes and all the stuff, whatever it is that you've been doing during the day, you see, and you go into the barracks, and you put on a uniform, a clean uniform. That is one of the little, strange, complete, physical, almost erotic satisfactions that you get in the Army. Of putting on something clean and escaping from all of that somehow, and you put on your clean ODs, very clean. You know, it's a class A uniform we're going to have tonight for the big retreat, and so you put on your class A uniform, which is your ODs, you see, with the dress uniform and all that. You put the whole jazz on, and you feel great. You just do, you know, and it's just getting nice and warm out there, and you're thinking, oh, boy, you know, they're going to... And you're looking forward to supper. You're hungry. You get hungrier than a skunk in the Army, let me tell you. You really get hungry in the Army. So you're really hungry, you know, and it's nice out, and it's soft, and you put your uniform on and everything. Well, then you go out and you stand, and you stand retreat. Well, now retreat, you stand there with your company or your platoon, and they all line up, great big lines, and you can see them for miles on either side. And there's this little ceremony, and they raise the flag, you know, or rather they take the flag down. The flag is taken out. Of course, it's usually done out on the parade ground, or what passes for the parade ground in certain areas. And it's a ceremony of lowering the flag at sunset. That's retreat. And they blow retreat. And the sound of retreat being blown across a flag, across the parade ground, it's a very strangely beautiful thing. That's all I can say. And I'm anything but militaristic. It is a strangely, because it's all connected with erotic things, like you got a clean shirt on, you know, and you're hungry. And you know that you got nothing to do the rest of the night, you know, just to go out and swing, go down to the PX and get Milky Ways. You know, really have a ball, go down and sit there and drink some knee-high orange and, you know, go down and watch the guys bowl. Watch the sergeants bowl. You see, most of the sergeants are on the bowling list. They've been on there, you know, since the beginning of the war. It's impossible to ever bowl. You have to be on the list. So nobody ever bowls except sergeants who are there or sergeants who play ping pong. You know, I know two staff sergeants who play ping pong continuously through the original landings in North Africa. They played ping pong all through Sicily, all through the Italian campaign, and were dislodged only when the landings in southern France took them back to the orderly room. That's a fact. These guys played ping pong for 3.5 straight years. Fantastic. And by the way, each of them got 3 promotions during the course of their enormous game. Just ping pong all day long. You know, you come into the day room. Well, that's beside the point. I'm going to tell you the truth. Everybody, all the GIs sitting out there are nodding their head. Yeah, man. Yeah, yeah. Go, man. And all of you, you civilians. Oh, come on. You're exaggerating. What do you mean exaggerating? I know one guy that played pool. Believe me, played pool throughout the entire duration of World War II. Pool. On the same pool table in Fort Monmouth. Probably still there. Still racking them up. Just out of sheer momentum. Can't stop now, you know. It's a nervous tick. Well, nevertheless, you got the scene, see, this beautiful scene of a retreat. Well, it was about 4:30, quarter to 5, on this beautiful, magnificent spring day in the Ozarks. Oh, I cannot tell you any place that is more beautiful in the spring than the Ozarks. You can see those blue hills climbing up behind, you know, way out beyond the edge of the camp, the foothills of the Ozarks, and they get blue in the springtime, and all kinds of wonderful smells are in the air. There's wild flowers, and it's just magnificent there at that time. Suddenly everything is awake and alive, you see. All the while the war is getting hotter, but it is a beautiful spring day. Well, about 4:30, quarter to 5, somebody in headquarters got a real inspiration. He's probably, you know, a sentimental old major, you know, from the old army is looking out. And he can see the sunset, you know, and he sees the flag floating there in the breeze, and he feels the old sap flowing, and he suddenly got the idea, let's get a real bugler. Let's get a real bugler. So the old major obviously turned to the old captain next to him, who turned to the old sergeant major next to him, who knew everything about everybody in the whole camp. Sergeant majors do, you know. So he says, anybody around here can blow a horn? Yeah, there's a guy down in K, in the 803rd. K, Homer Croft, I believe. PFC, yeah. That guy's one of the greatest buglers I ever heard. Of course, you see, because the aura of it was all around Croft, you know? Greatest bugler anyone ever heard. He only blew the comb. But he blew every known bugle call all the way back to the Afghan rifles, you know? So within 10 minutes, we're all down in the barracks putting our suit on, you know, getting ready for this thing. When the squawk goes, Croft, 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 go to the battalion headquarters, quick, Croft, Croft. Hurry up, for crying out loud, the major wants to see you down there. Well, Croft gets up, well, one day, what the devil they want? He hollers at the squawk box, shut up, Croft, get down there, will you, will you, will you? Well, Croft gets up in his Class A uniform, and he hightails it out to battalion headquarters. Little did we realize that Croft was heading for one of the great traumatic experiences of his aggressive, rotten southern life. So Croft... Well, needless to say, when we all lined up out there for this beautiful retreat ceremony, a tiny figure is standing next to the flagpole. And on either side of him are two men holding painted white rifles, wearing the full ceremonial garb of the Signal Corps. Three other guys are getting ready to lower the flag, and Homer Croft is out there holding a B-flat issue GI brass trumpet, subtitled Bugle. And we're all looking down, and we're going to have a real bugle, you know, a real one. Well, I could see Croft down there, and we're all lined up. Of course, he's our man, you know, this is our boy. Boy, old Company K is shining tonight. And you could hear the battalion major saying, then all the way down the line, well, I don't have to go into the rest of it. The first notes of Croft's retreat started to echo throughout the canyon. It was one of the worst examples of bugle blowing that has ever been heard this side of the Cub Pack, over in Teaneck, New Jersey. Croft not only didn't have a lip, he apparently had never blown a bugle in his life. But Croft gutted it out. Croft blew that thing for seemed like over 5 hours. Ah, 800 guys stood there with little things running up and down their spines. It was a fantastic moment of truth.